This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to the Pomp Podcast, simply the best podcast out there. Let's kick this thing off.
Alex Zvetsky is the co-founder and CEO of Amber, a mobile company focused on making exposure to Bitcoin and the new wave of digital assets as simple, low risk, and automated as possible. In this conversation, we discuss the Bitcoin halving, how natural systems function, why quantitative hardening matters, and what Ray Dalio is missing on his analysis of Bitcoin. I really enjoyed this episode with Alex, and I think you will as well. Before we get into the episode, though, I want to quickly talk about our sponsors. The first is BlockFi. They allow you to keep your crypto, put it up as collateral, and receive either a US dollar loan funded directly to your bank account or interest in an interest-bearing account. They do all kinds of loan sizes, and they pay up to 8.6% APY in their interest-bearing accounts. I'm a user, an investor, and a huge fan. They're perfect for helping you reach your financial goals of all sizes. Visit BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, BlockFi.com/pomp to learn more about putting your crypto to work without having to sell it. BlockFi.com/pomp. Lastly, don't forget, I write a daily letter to over 45,000 investors about business, technology, and finance. I break down complex topics into easy-to-understand language while sharing opinions on various aspects of each industry. You can subscribe at pompletter.com, pompletter.com, or go into the description and click the link. All right, let's get into this episode with Alex. I hope you guys enjoy this one.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I've got Alex here. I'm super excited to do this. This is round two, my friend. You ready to go?
I'm ready to go. Cripple, non-cripple, whatever way, I'm ready.
let's start off with, for those that didn't listen to the first episode or don't remember, maybe just give us a quick 2 minutes on your background and then what you're doing with Amber.
Cool. So 2 minutes, I guess. I would fit into the camp of, you know, toxic Bitcoin maxis or whatever the hell they're, you know, categorizing us as today. I think the last podcast that you and I did, we were talking about the importance of Bitcoiners being, you know, this intolerant minority, standing in the middle and, you know, and not giving ground. And I think that's an extremely important function of any system. You know, there's got to be a group of people who just won't bend. And I think that's what, you know, I kind of align with those Bitcoiners the most. And, you know, through that, you know, I really think Bitcoin's the most important thing happening in the world today. And my, you know, I've got a philosophical expression of that through doing the writing and podcasts and all that sort of stuff. But my entrepreneurial expression of that is a little product called Amber. And Amber is designed to be a Bitcoin accumulation app. So I kind of differentiate it from, you know, the Coinbases of the world. It's not a trading app. You know, it's not designed for you to sort of, you know, trade shit coins or, you know, like it's not, or to, you know, buy and sell and all this sort of stuff. It's really designed to accumulate Bitcoin in a fashion that's as automated as possible. So we kind of led the whole DCA move. And there's a lot of people now doing DCA and we're doing some cool things now we're going to introduce a premium feature to Amber that'll make sat stacking smarter, more automated, and cheaper for everyone.
So we are we're investors. I don't even know if we've announced that yet.
We haven't yet.
we just did. And so give us an update, just kind of any metrics or data so people know how it's going.
Yeah, so we're in Oz at the moment. We've got almost 5,000 users there. We're about to roll out. I guess I'm putting the final touches here on this Europe situation, which has proven to be, you know, interesting at the very least, dealing with, you know, compliance and banking and all that sort of stuff. So we're down to now selecting the bank that we're going to partner with, which is good. So very shortly, we'll be able to deliver this now to Europe. I'm hoping for June. That's the plan. And yeah, man, we'll be able to really deliver a nice, clean way for people to accumulate Bitcoin in a broader region. And then from there, we're just like, I want to hit South Africa, and then want to look at some other markets as well.
For sure. And so the big debate right now or conversation is we are, what, 7-8 days away from the Bitcoin halving.
Mm-hmm.
And this has historically been a major moment. I'll go as far as to say historic moment.
Yep.
What's kind of your general thoughts about the halving and how that's going to kind of affect the entire industry?
Yeah, look, I wrote an article recently, you know, about the halving and just sort of talking a little bit about, you know, I wanted to take a different spin on all the conversations going on around the halving. So obviously Plan B really brought the concept of the halving to the fore with the stock to flow model and all of that sort of stuff. And I think a lot of the conversation has been really around price and price targets and, you know, this model about, you know, how to get rich tomorrow by buying Bitcoin. And that's fine because, you know, Bitcoin is it's a monetary beast, right? So the more capital we get flowing into this thing, the better, and it just makes it stronger. But what I kind of wanted to focus on was this divergence in philosophy. So, you know, the world we live in today has become, you know, one of more, now, with, you know, blind excess and complete disregard to like the consequences, the cost, the ethics and the sustainability of the decisions we make today, which, you know, every decision comes at a cost, you know, and those decisions that we make today are generally at the expense of the future. So, you know, COVID has been like another one of these, you know, knee-jerk reactions, you know, my exponentials and, you know, taking things to an extreme in the way we deal with them, because we're so easily triggered and we don't stop for a moment to think about the longer term ramifications of anything we do. And, you know, here you've got this incredibly symbolic event in the halving. You know, I kind of like to say that whilst the world is, you know, doubling, tripling and going exponential, Bitcoin is, you know, halving and, you know, going towards a finite, you know, end supply. And that's such a divergence in philosophy. Like, you know, here we are, everything is becoming abundant and, you know, cheap, whereas we've forgotten what is scarce and valuable. And, you know, Bitcoin kind of stands alone as the pillar of, you know, traditional way we understand value, you know, something that is unique. You know, and I could use an example of, you know, a fine piece of art, like, you know, that there is one Mona Lisa, or, you know, your mother, you've got one mother, she's fundamentally valuable to you because she's fundamentally unique. Like if you could just print your mum, you know, 1,000 times, like she's not going to be as valuable. So these things are, this is such an interesting, to me, philosophical divergence. And it's just funny to see how the world is forking at this point in time, with, you know, Bitcoin being this thing on one side where, and all the madness that's happening on the other side. So that's kind of how I envision the halving. And I think it's, yeah, I think this is probably the first halving. Like the last halving was, yeah, you know, not many people knew about it. I think this is the first one that's getting a bit of airtime. I don't know, my guess is 2024, it's going to be like it's going to be like one of those New Year's Eve events, you know, that everyone's sort of watching and counting down for. It's going to be really interesting.
Yeah, one of the best frameworks that I've heard for this is while the world is quantitative easing, right, and kind of expanding that sheet, the balance sheet, Bitcoin is quantitative hardening.
Yeah.
And to me, like that just puts this whole concept in the same terminology that financial experts know and understand. Right. And kind of the people in the traditional world, when they look at it that way, it's like, oh, okay, hold on a second. Quantitative easing versus quantitative hardening. One of those sounds a lot better than the other, right?
Absolutely. And that's sort of that again ties up with, you know, easy versus hard. Like, you know, there's things in life, like if you want to be, let's just take happiness as a thing. If you want to live a life of happiness, you can either go and grab some heroin and start shooting up and just, you know, be in bliss the whole time and, you know, probably die from an overdose. Or you can take the hard road, which is live a life of meaning. And to live a life of meaning, you're going to have to go through, you know, pain, suffering, sacrifice, loss, and all that sort of stuff. But it's going to build depth in your character. It's going to build strength. It's going to, you're going to grow as a human being. And that is the harder path. It's the, you know, it's the path of the Stoic, you know, it's, but it's sort of been drummed out of society, you know, like we're, everything's apparently got to come easy. Whether it's our money, whether it's our, you know, the 5-minute abs or, you know, whatever other bullshit is sold to us, you know, the cheap plastic shit. It's just crazy. So I really love Bitcoin for that shift in ideology. I think that's where not enough of our focus goes when we're thinking about Bitcoin.
What do you think it's going to take for this to go from what I'll call kind of a niche community in the global world, right? You know, maybe 1% of the world's population is even kind of using Bitcoin, bought Bitcoin, hold Bitcoin. And out of that 1%, I don't know, let's say 50% really, really understand it. That's probably me being generous, right?
Yeah,
in terms of kind of the framework and the difference. What does it take for that to grow on a percentage basis? So people who already hold Bitcoin go from, let's say, 50% to closer to 100%. But also, how do we get from 1% of the total global population to 10%, right? And kind of, I think of it almost like a penetration of a market. What's kind of the thoughts there?
I think so. I've got the pain and curiosity theory, I kind of call it. So I think people come to Bitcoin for two reasons, pain or curiosity. So curiosity in the sense that you're interested in what this technology is, you're interested in, you know, money. I guess you could probably add a third one there, greed. You know, and greed, I think, gets a bad rap. Greed is an interesting thing. I've got Gordon Gekko actually in my article, where, you know, greed is actually fundamentally good because it's a driver for human progress. And it, you know, helps us thrive. Now, greed unchecked, just as anything else, is bad. You know, like food is a good thing, but if all you do is eat all day, you're going to get fat, right? So as with anything, you know, there's a sensible medium. But I think greed, curiosity. So those who are curious enough to want to inquire about what is Bitcoin or what is money or how is society shifting, what's going on, are going to get into it. But I think, unfortunately, more people will discover Bitcoin because of some level of pain. And maybe fortunately or unfortunately, I don't know, that's not, I guess, my place to judge. But I think the pain piece is probably, you know, going to be the largest driver. And that may be pain from, I don't know, watching your currency collapse, like what's happening in Lebanon now, watching, you know, your own personal finances collapse. So let's say you're, you know, living in America at the moment and you're forced to stay home against your will, even though you're young, fit, healthy, and you have a very minimal chance of some invisible virus coming to get you. But you're forced to stay home and go broke, and you get given some measly little $1,200, you know, US dollar check, and that's apparently going to last you 10 weeks, right? You know, so you know, that pain is going to drive you to say, well, this is fucking bullshit. And then, you know, whilst that's happening on one side, you know, the prices of your goods are going up because production stopped and money's losing its purchasing power. So at some point, something's going to snap and you're going to be like, you know, I need to, something's going to drive. So it's kind of like a carrot and a stick. You know, the carrot is probably the curiosity and greed, and the stick is the pain. And as we know, throughout society and throughout history, it's usually the stick that drives the most change. And I think we're just sort of lucky in the period of time that we live in that we have something like Bitcoin as an exit strategy. for that, because people in the past haven't had this.
Yeah, and this isn't like academic theory, right? Like, we're literally seeing this play out in Lebanon right now.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Where literally the national currency has lost almost 50% of its purchasing power in a very short period of time. The banks implemented all kinds of capital controls, so you can only withdraw a certain amount every day. They won't let you withdraw in any currency other than the Lebanese currency. And then on top of that, it's during the coronavirus where people have lost their jobs. And so what ends up happening is people literally go to sleep. When they wake up in the morning, they have two questions. How much of my wealth did I lose overnight? Because I lost actual purchasing power. And then two is, do I have enough money to go buy groceries? Because at the same time that you're losing the value of your currency, food prices and other prices are skyrocketing. Going up.
Yeah, exactly. It's mental. It's absolutely mental.
What is the catalyst, do you think, like, or the tipping point where we go from, it's happening in Lebanon right now. And I genuinely believe most people, they want to be happy and they want to have some level of freedom, right? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, that's what they want. And that manifests itself in a whole bunch of different ways of life. But ultimately, they want to be able to spend time with their loved ones, be free, not have to worry about access to food or shelter, and kind of the basic needs of human life. But if the current system makes that hard, we see it on a micro level, do we have to wait for that to happen on a macro level where it's happening in multiple kind of global superpowers in order for people to wake up and shift over? Or can we go kind of population by population and slowly but surely you get some people who say, hey, I don't want to participate in this Lebanese pound mirage anymore. I'm going to opt out. And then after decades, you get kind of a majority of people who have opted out.
Yeah, I was writing a piece. So yesterday I released my little piece called Correcting Dalio after his little second chapter that he wrote about changing world powers. And one of the sections I wrote in there was about this idea of a phase shift. So if we think about water, for example, it's got these three primary forms that it comes in: solid, ice, liquid water, and gas, steam, right? And as the temperature increases, it remains in its state, but there's something happening at a molecular level that's sort of basically invisible. And then you have this situation where it's like slowly, 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 but all at once. And then the phase shifts. And my guess is that society is probably very similar in that sense. Is, you have this undercurrent of change, that's sort of like the zeitgeist of the time that, that is happening. And because societal shifts are much longer in nature, and I'm not talking about Dalio's 70-year debt cycle. I'm talking more like societal shifts of the separation of church and state 500 years ago. Now we're sort of seeing the separation of money and state. Like this is a multi-year, multi-decade transformation. But that sort of phase shift period, I think, has an undercurrent, but at some point. And I think Connor Brown used to have this on his Twitter profile. It's like slowly, but then all at once. I think that's going to be the situation where it starts to cascade. And when is anyone's guess? I was going to touch on something there. Where was I going with this? I had a point.
So I think part of it though is just like the gradually, but then all at once, or slowly, but then suddenly, I think is mm-hmm. another one like the Unchained guys use. The idea really comes down to what are the accelerants? And at some point, do you hit a point of no return, right? Like I call it like burning the boats, right? Mm-hmm. The whole idea of burning the boats is when you go and you find new land, back in the day, you're not actually committed to staying until you burn the boats. When you burn the boats, like you can't go back, right? Yeah. So when do we get to that point?
Well, here we are burning the boats right now. I think COVID was an example of burning the boats, right? It's, we just – burnt the the interest rate boat. Then we burnt the QE infinity boat. So those two boats are burnt now. What else is there? Like the number of boats that are available to burn to basically discredit the existing system, are becoming less and less numerous. I mean, I always say COVID was one of the best marketing campaigns for Bitcoin in history, because like these are the events that I just remember. The analogy I was going to use earlier was the smartphone analogy. Like, we can all remember a time before smartphones, like when we all had flip phones or the shitty Nokia banana phones and all that sort of stuff. We remember the dumb phones, and we remember when that was ubiquitous. And we also remember when, you know, modern times now, like when smartphones are completely ubiquitous. But that transition period, I can't exactly remember that. I'm not really clear on when we had like a real good mix of smartphones and dumb phones at the same time. Like that phase shift like happened so quickly. And I think, you know, we're obviously not at that point yet with Bitcoin, but I think over the next decade, the question is going to shift from, you know, people asking today is like, why the hell would you have Bitcoin, to sometime in the next decade, the question will be, why the hell don't you have Bitcoin? Like, so that strange look, like the question will change. And I mean, maybe the trigger is going to be something as crazy as I've got a friend of mine who's another Bitcoiner in Australia, Haas McCook. He put a tweet out a little while ago saying, my prediction for next year is 40,000 in the Dow and 40% unemployment. And that to me, like, I mean, as crazy as that sounds, like what we're seeing right now with these supposed solution to the COVID problem is, you know, all this printing of money, bailing out of the big boys and all this sort of stuff, is we're actually tearing society apart. And we're, you know, we have this illusion of prosperity in the stock market. You know, basically the NASDAQ's almost back at all-time highs. I mean, Shopify's blown through its highs, Amazon's blown through its highs, Tesla's basically back at highs. You know, Uber and Lyft are back at, you know, beyond their December price. It's such insanity. But at the same time, we've got almost 30% unemployment in the US. Nobody's working. Everyone's at home. And, you know, everyone's living on a $1,200, you know, handout. It's like Main Street and Wall Street are completely diverging. It's madness. And maybe that's what triggers people to say, you know, I've had enough.
I keep thinking about just like the virus itself has done two things. One, it's accelerated a lot of trends. One, you just mentioned, of kind of the wealth inequality gap, right, is definitely getting accelerated right now by kind of the government's response to this virus. But also the virus has exposed many shams in society, right, whether it's higher education and all of the kind of the structure of that or other things. And the part to me that I've thought very critically about this and shied away from really talking about it too much because it's so sensitive. But ultimately, here in the United States, what we see is there's federal income tax. But if the government can print whatever money they need, why are people paying taxes, right? It's kind of like a business saying, like, why do I actually charge the customers when they come in if I can just keep editing my bank account and making my bank account have more money in it? Like, then I don't actually need to sell anything. I can just give away the goods, right? I don't understand, why am I actually charging people for it? Same thing here. It's like, why is the government charging federal income tax if they can just print whatever they want? What are kind of the thoughts there?
Well, dude, that's one of those boats being burnt, right? It's, this idea that it's funny that you mention that, because I was during this lockdown period, I was stuck with one person who's got a really different viewpoint than me about, you know, how the world works, and very kind of like, call it a socialist viewpoint, right? The government's going to save us all and all this sort of stuff. And then when I sort of asked, when I bring up this point, like, I got her straight around to my level of thinking. I said, so tell me, why are you paying taxes? And, you know, she explained, oh, you know, the hospitals and this and that. And I said, well, you do realize that, you know, more was just printed in a couple of days than taxes gathered in a couple of years. to apparently bail us out. So I go, why don't they just do that and build the hospitals? And then she was like, that can't be right. That shouldn't happen. Like, so it doesn't make actual sense when you think about it for a second. So it's, I mean, this is the issue, I guess, that Bitcoin was originally designed to solve. A lot of people, and this is where I scratch my head at, like, the Bcashers and all the other crypto people who are running around promoting faster payments and all that sort of shit, which is nothing, none of that matters when you look at why Bitcoin was designed in the first place, which is to remove concentrated control or concentrated ability for the resource through which we measure society to be managed by someone. So like when you remove that, then you can't play these games where, you know, a business, instead of selling products, just edits their bank account. Like, you know, what we're doing is we're disincentivizing real production, which is effectively the driver of economies. We're taking that out of the equation and we're just making fucking numbers up. Like, how deranged does one have to be to think that this is normal? In no way is it normal. That's not economics. That's not society. That's not capital. And the funny thing is people try and call it capitalism. It's like, that is not capitalism, dude. Like, that's not the definition of capitalism. The definition of capitalism is build capital through production and through adding value and through creating efficiencies whereby you can, you know, create profit. And profit is just measures how much relative value you've added in, or relative input you've had in society. Like, that's a good thing. And people are trying to sit here and, you know, blame capitalism and support the government just making up numbers in their own ledger. It's completely wild.
My favorite way to articulate this is Marty Bent says, fix the money, fix the world. Right. And it literally is, so many problems in the world derive from this money issue.
They do. Because here's the thing, like, if money is the board, is the board upon which we play the game of life or the game of society, if one player or a couple players can just change the rules whenever they want, but the rest of us have to play by those rules, you tear apart the board. Like, it's no longer the same game. We're playing two different games and you're going to debalance the whole thing. And this is what people don't get. But the problem is the guys who are get to change the rules for themselves, they're actually part of a bigger game, which they can't get out of, which is they live, you know, in the same world as we do. So at some point, when you tear apart the fabric of society by distorting through things like, oh, yep, we're going to, you know, you and I, Pomp, and everybody else who's listened to this, we have to go out and we have to trade our two finite resources, time and energy, so that we add value to society in order to be rewarded with this unit called money. Whereas a couple people in society, they get to just make it up out of thin air. You start to break the game down. And what you end up doing is you create ramifications such as 40,000 DAO, 40% unemployment. Like, you basically make the whole thing fall apart. But once the whole thing falls apart, they basically fuck themselves over and they fuck everyone else over in the process. And it's just such a, I don't know, short-term viewpoint. It's such an arrogant way of thinking. But unfortunately, that's what happens when the needle is so close, right? You know, when you've got a junkie and the temptation to feel good is right there, you know, they're going to use it. So the best solution is get rid of the temptation altogether. Throw that out. And that's, you know, as Marty says, fix the money, you fix everything. So you throw the temptation to fuck with the fabric of society out the window. When that is out, when you cannot do it, guess what? Your energies go towards some form of productive action, and that starts to coalesce and converge to a more structurally functional society, not one where, you know, a group of people can change the rules in their favor.
And so I guess as as part of this, then it happens all over the world. It's not just a U.S. thing. It's not just kind of a global superpower thing. This literally happens everywhere. And so my guess is that we're going to see people, regardless of geography, start to wake up and slowly move. At first, it'll be percentages of their wealth. Eventually, it'll be larger and larger, and even into the majority, overly decentralized, kind of digital. What does that infrastructure look right now? Can we handle kind of another 2017? And if not, what do you think we need to actually change or improve in order to be ready for that?
That's a good question. Okay, so I think we're definitely ready for another 2017. I think the the on-ramps are better. There's whether we're talking about Amber or whether we're talking about the boys at Swan or River and all this sort of stuff. There's a lot better Bitcoin onboarding services these days. So I think we can structurally have that. SegWit's broadly adopted. So we're not going to get those ridiculous spikes in fees. Wallets are smarter. So you're not going to get that. So I think that's fine. I personally believe we'll probably see a run, later this year or next year. In my mind, again, it's going to be a price-driven run. So I think this rise in Bitcoin is going to be probably more like, if we think about those drivers of pain, curiosity, greed, it's probably going to be another greed driven driver at this point in time, because I think as much as these stimulus packages and all this sort of shit haven't solved the problem, they've managed to at least give a sense of solution. Like, it feels like there's been a band-aid applied to some of this apparent bleeding. So I think Bitcoin fundamentally does have the infrastructure from an onboarding and from a functionality standpoint to support another big run. And I think it's really going to kick off once we pass the old all-time highs. So once Bitcoin's beyond 20,000, what we'll probably have is a period of disbelief. So maybe, it crosses 20,000. People are like, oh shit, that Bitcoin thing's back at 20,000. Oh, it's going to fall again from here, and then I'll buy some, and then it'll, probably reach 25,000. They'll be like, oh no, it can't go any higher than this. This is another bubble. It'll hit 30. And I think that's when we'll start to get some serious FOMO. And that's when we'll start to see, retail market and all that sort of stuff come in. Does that sort of answer the question, or?
I definitely think so. What are you excited about kind of post-halving, right? So we're coming into this event, kind of how are you thinking about once we get past that, and what are you looking forward to?
I guess the told you so moments. So I think the classic, all the Rubinis of the world and all of that sort of stuff who've just said that this thing's going to, whether go to zero or it's never going to pass the all-time high, it was just a tulip bubble, all that sort of stuff. I think that's really, and not from an arrogant place, but just from a rewarding place. Like, we've stood strong this entire time. Like, all the people who've stuck with it in the bear market, particularly the people that came in 2016, 2017, like this sort of, we call it the class of, this epoch, right? It's, there was the class that came before that was sort of between 2012 and 2016. They've already seen a bear market. The people that have come in between 2016 and 2018, or between 2016 and now, have seen this new bear market. And coming out of that on the other end and sort of being proven right, not to gloat, but to sort of inspire more people to come in, that's probably what I'm looking forward to the most. Because then guess what? We basically enlarge the circle of hodlers, of believers, of that critical mass of people, that intolerant minority that won't bend over, or that won't go back to the old system. I was speaking to someone yesterday on a fintech podcast, and I was kind of just saying, you know, when I first got into Bitcoin, my idea was to sort of get in and get out and make money and make dollars. Now it's not, I'm trying to gain territory on Bitcoin. So for me, it's like a one-way street. I'm going in, I'm not coming back out. Like, you know, why would you, you know, move to a new, like, place which is beautiful, that has everything you could one day need, just to move out again? Like, it makes no sense to me. So, like, you know, we're pioneers in this new world, and I think we're just gonna, this post halving is gonna validate a lot of the things that we've been saying to people for the last year or two or longer.
One of the best ways I've heard people talk about this is everyone understands the concept of land, right? They're not making more of it, and owning land has value. If you can break that model to, or bend that model to understand digital land, right, or digital property, and you say, hey, there's only 21 million acres, right? And you can buy one right now for $8,900, right? Do you think they're going to be worth more or less in the future, right?
Simple, yeah.
And by the way, look, just like land, there's price fluctuations. Sometimes certain areas there, it's more valuable or less valuable, right? But generally over long periods of time, the scarce assets rise in price. And that has to do with one, there being more desirability, but also two, it's actually the currency being devalued against the scarce asset, right? Meaning that the US dollar or whatever is losing purchasing power. And so it takes more of those dollars to buy that same asset. And when people hear that, I think that kind of clicks and say, oh, wait, that is interesting. Explain that more.
Yeah. So we've got, so you just mentioned two forces there that that basically are inversely correlated, but they drive each other, which is the devaluing of the current currency that we're using to price this new thing, but also the scarcity and the fixed supply of this new thing, which can't, you know, once people understand that it can't be printed or you can't make more of it, you know, the common sense thing is, all right, well, infinite, finite, you know, that's where more value is. But then you've also got the third piece, like, yeah, you know, let's argue that someone could create something that is finite in supply, but it's completely useless. You know, that probably won't accrue value. So like, if we look at Bitcoin, it is fundamentally useful. You know, it's digital, divisible, portable. It's got all these sorts of incredible primitives. Another one that I was discussing yesterday with someone was, and this is something that I've experienced firsthand as a fintech company. For us, for example, to be able to accept credit card payments to help people buy Bitcoin, man, I'm about 2.5 or 3 weeks through a due diligence process with so much paperwork, so much checks, so much garbage that, like, I can't even explain to you how much time and effort has been wasted just to give us as a company the permission to help somebody buy a product called Bitcoin. Like, if in a world where Bitcoin is a functional money, that permission doesn't need to be, you know, chased. Like, you don't have any of that. So all of that friction, all of that wasted time, energy, resources, shit that doesn't actually add value to anything, is gone. Like, you literally throw that out. Like, I think even Jack Dorsey was talking about it. He was saying, you know, Square is a fintech company, but it's fundamentally unable to operate like an internet company because of all of these jurisdictional limits that exist because of the current fragmented, you know, horse and buggy financial system that we have. Like, Bitcoin is completely and entirely different beast. It's that, I mean, coming back to a Peter Thielism, right, is it's the 0 to 1. It looks nothing like the existing financial system. And that, therein lies the innovation. It's not, you know, all these fintech bros running around trying to, you know, augment the existing financial system and make some things faster and, you know, build some new API and all this. That's all cool and well, you know, it's cute basically, but it's not a fundamental reinvention. It's nothing new. It's not an iPhone versus a Nokia banana phone. Like, it's a complete reinvention of money, payments, and all in the one stack. And that, I think, when you layer that on top of the land argument, So you've got this thing which is not 10 times, but 100 times more superior. And then you say it's finite in supply. And then you say that you can show that this other thing that we're using at the moment is not only infinite in supply, but it's also devaluing, it's broken and all this sort of shit. Like, you literally have to be a maniac or a moron or ignorant, or I don't know what you have to be to sort of dismiss Bitcoin as a scam. Like, I literally don't get it anymore. Like, I see no reason why someone shouldn't have not only, you know, some of their wealth in Bitcoin, but any wealth that they actually value in Bitcoin. Simple as that.
Yeah, it's this whole idea of get off zero, right? I mean, look, we went around the country, the United States, and even internationally, and just over and over and over again, get off zero, get off zero. Because there's two things. One is there's obviously a exposure to the upside that has a material impact on a portfolio. But two is once you have kind of skin in the game, you start paying attention, right? Mm-hmm. And I literally used to tell people, take $100, put it in Bitcoin, and think of it as you just invested in an education. Because I promise you, you'll pay attention. Right. And I think that works for people.
Man, it works for absolutely everyone. Like my mom, who's got no financial literacy whatsoever, I got her to buy some Bitcoin and I get these random texts from, like, my mom's the kind of person where when she saw the whole Libra news last year, she was like, oh, Facebook is setting up their own Bitcoin. Like that's the kind of, you know, comment that I would get from my mom, right? But even she's like messaging me saying, oh, you know, Bitcoin's gone up again. Like, it's such an interesting thing to see. But that's what skin in the game does to you, right? It's, you know, when you start to, yeah, when you have some skin in the game, you've got something to burn and then all of a sudden it becomes important to you. You know, when there's an ability to feel pain, and this is why pain receptors are such an important piece of any system, like, you know, tying it back to this whole COVID thing and how, you know, we're in a society now that wants to eliminate any form of pain. You know, we feel a little bit sick, we hit ourselves with painkillers, you know, we you know, painkillers or medication or antidepressants, or, you know, the economy is down a little bit, let's print more money, let's artificially drop interest rates. Like all we're doing is we're masking the problem. We're slapping these random band-aids over problems. And every single time, you know, particularly from an economic standpoint, I think that's where we mess with things the most. Well, maybe not. Maybe we mess with things practically everywhere. But every single time these complex natural systems, biological, economic, or whatever, try and correct themselves, try and come back to their own natural equilibrium, in we come with some sort of intervention to apparently fix it, right? Like, you know, these interventions that people say are so necessary, like the market was so overextended, and not just talking from a, the market needed a crash, you know, standpoint, but everything was overextended. Like whether you talk about supply chain and just in time, like there was no savings, there was stock buybacks for the sake of stock buybacks. All of this stuff was so overextended. And fundamentally, the economy needed to take a breath. And Corona was an opportunity to take a breath and come back to some equilibrium. And therein, that was the solution, that the fall was the solution. And we've somehow been taught that the correction or that fall or that crash is the bad thing, that the solution is pumping more drugs into the system to inflate it back up. And it's become such a backwards kind of, you know, level of thinking, because, you know, corrections, equilibrium, pain, death, they're necessary in any system, you know, whether at the cellular level, the atomic level, through to the economic level, through to the societal level, up through to the interstellar, you know, cosmic level. Like, you know, life and death, they're symbiotic. And the more we try and avoid death, the more we try and avoid pain as if it's a plague, the more we actually damage life. You know, Jordan Peterson talks about this, the forest fires. You know, forests have natural fires that burn regularly all the freaking time. And by doing that, you know, you have these spores that are released, you know, that only are released during these fires and all this sort of stuff. Then, you know, humans come in and we're like, oh, fires are a bad thing, you know, like a blanket statement. We stop the fires from happening. And then all of a sudden you have this one big fire that comes and destroys everything. And not only burns everything down, but it burns the topsoil. So now the forest is a freaking desert and you've destroyed it. It's such a, the more you play with these levers of a complex system, the more you have these exogenous events that you just can't measure. And you actually destroy the system itself instead of allowing it to correct. And this is, it's just crazy, man.
That's how natural systems function, right? It is, you got to kind of let them do what they do for the most part. And the more you interfere, the more issues that you can cause.
Yeah.
But before we finish up, I wanted to spend some time. You recently read Ray Dalio's new chapter that he released, chapter 2 for his new book. Mm-hmm. And you wrote a pretty deep dive on basically what you think he got wrong. Right. Mm-hmm. So maybe spend a little bit of time kind of talking through that. I know you mentioned it earlier, but just, you know, what your takeaways were and kind of what do you think he got wrong?
Well, I think so. I'll hit on a couple of pieces. Number one, he talks about, you know, understanding money, debt and credit and all that sort of stuff. But then, you know, he starts with that, but then he gives like such a really weak definition of what money is. He's like, oh, you know, money is a medium of exchange and it's also sometimes used as a storehold of wealth. I was reading that, I'm like, what? Like, you can't exchange something that's not, you know, valuable in the first place. So it's like that, you know, it doesn't make sense. And I sort of argued that unless you give, you know, a much deeper definition of money, the whole argument that his entire chapter sits on just falls apart. So, you know, I kind of like to define money as something deeper. It's, you know, it's a mechanism via which participants in society can effectively collaborate. Like if you don't have that mechanism, society goes out the window. You can't, like, you know, money is used to represent the products of one's time and labor. In other words, you know, their work. And if you don't get that depth, you don't appreciate how important money is. And then you can, you know, call it something as stupid as, oh, it's just the medium of exchange. So that's sort of where he starts off. Then he starts talking about, you know, yeah, money doesn't have intrinsic value, blah, blah, blah. But then he turns around and starts to talk about how gold became money because it has intrinsic value. And then I was like face palming myself again. I'm like, okay. There's no such thing as intrinsic value. All value is subjective. Simple as that. Like, and like the example that I like to use is, you know, we all value air, right? Like the ability to breathe. But if you have a child and you're both, let's say, in a car accident and you fall off a bridge and you're in the water and only one of you is going to be able to breathe, what are you going to value more in that moment? I know this is a brutal example, but you're going to value air or you're going to value your child's life. So it's a very, what that means is that at that point in time, the value you place on air is much lower than the value you place on, you know, your child's life, for example. So it's all value is subjective. Now, gold didn't become money because of some notion of intrinsic value. It has specific attributes that we converged upon as human beings to say that, hey, that is a really good object to represent the time and work that I'm trading for money. So that was another area. Then there was a couple of sections that me and him agreed on. He talks about how central banks are able to rig the game, and he's 100% right, because that's one of those things where I can see it was highlighted in my article. You know, whilst the rest of us idiots spend our two finite resources, time and energy, to receive money in return, you know, there's a few organizations who just gets to change the rules for themselves at the expense of the rest of us. And it's madness. Then what else did I hit? Things about where he talks, okay, so he mentions a section in there, while the virus triggered this particular financial and economic downturn, something else would have eventually triggered it, which I agree with. And regardless of what it did, the dynamic value would have basically been the same, because only intervention would have worked to reverse the downturn. And I kind of really like poked at that, which is we didn't actually reverse the downturn. I actually think we've just accelerated the downturn. By intervening again, we didn't actually fix anything. We broke the shit even more than it was broken before. So the correction, or this corona crash, or whatever we're going to label it as, was the system fixing itself. And instead of getting out of the way and allowing the system to fix itself, we just doubled down on breaking the fucking thing. And for me, when I see someone who's supposedly, you know, as intelligent or whatever as Ray is, to assume that these interventions are some form of solution just baffles me, because it's not what we're doing. Like we can't perpetuate that narrative, because all we're doing is running the same game again. Like the narrative has to be the system is fixing itself by correcting, and we are breaking it more by intervening, not the opposite way around. And until we do that, we're never going to fix shit.
Why do you think that he hasn't, at least publicly, kind of crossed the chasm and said, hey, this Bitcoin thing is real? Do you think it's that he doesn't understand it, he doesn't believe in it, or it's more of a sleight of hand and actually he's doing one thing behind closed doors and not talking about it publicly?
Yeah, dude, this one's one I've battled with for a long time. So, I mean, most of the writing that he does, like particularly prior writing, this one, I think there was a lot of, if you asked me that question 6 months ago, I would have probably said it's the latter. I think that, you know, there's a bit of sleight of hand going here and he's buying up Bitcoin like a boss in the background. But reading this one, I was like, you know, man, he's actually missing a few really fundamental pieces, like, you know, intrinsic value being one of them, and, you know, presuppositions around, you know, he's right about credit cycles, but he's defining everything within that paradigm. And, you know, he talks about these paradigm shifts, but he seems to be unable to acknowledge that Bitcoin is an example of a paradigm shift, you know, or a phase shift, something that is different to what exists. So he's either, there's either something really, really, really not clicking for him with respect to Bitcoin, or he's just, because he's got such a, I guess, a public presence, it may be dangerous to, you know, publicly promote Bitcoin, because, I mean, you know, you got this $200 billion asset now, which, I mean, if he turns around and says, you know, Bridgewater is allocating to Bitcoin, you know, we're probably gonna, we don't need the halving. It'll be called the Dalio inning. Like,
it's gonna, Renaissance came out and said that they're going to start playing, right? Well, now they're market makers, so they're going to be less buy and hold, but still, I think there are definitely firms that are waking up to what's happening here.
Well, there's another example of that slowly and then all at once, right? It's at some point the game theory is going to suggest that, you know, everyone piles in, and it's going to be mental, man, when the actual, that thing starts to actually happen. But yeah, I don't know, man. Dalio is an interesting case. I feel like he should know better, but maybe he doesn't. I don't know.
Listen, we're gonna find out for sure. With Amber, you guys are not yet available in the United States. You're gonna be available in Europe soon. For people who want to find out more, and kind of see what you guys are doing around DCA and the various features that you've built, where can they go to learn more?
They can go to amber.app. So amber.app. That'll redirect to our normal site, which is actually getamber.io. So we haven't switched it to the new thing yet. So don't freak out when you see it. But yeah, amber.app, all the stuff's there. And then on Twitter, it's the Amber app. That's the tag. So TheAmberApp. So that's where people can find out. I would suggest I'm going to release an article probably in the next week or two, once I get some more solid dates around Europe, so people can keep track of when we're going to be live there. I know we had a recent casualty in Europe for one of the DCA services called GetBitter, decided to shut down because, as you know, in the infinite wisdom of the Dutch regulators, they decided to introduce some ridiculous new licenses, which basically made it unfeasible for GetBitter to operate out of Holland where they were. So unfortunately, they're out of the market. So, you know, we're now trying to make sure we can get in there to service people that were that are no longer able to be serviced in Europe.
Yeah. I'm going to leave you with one question. You have no clue that I'm going to ask you this. What is the one piece of content or writing that you wish somebody else or yourself would write? So what's the one thing that hasn't been really heavily scrutinized, debated, kind of laid out that you say, I would love to see X?
Shit, you know what I thought you were going to ask me? I thought you were going to ask me, what is the one piece of writing that I would recommend as indispensable? shit, this is a good question. It's hard for me to say because I've recently just started reading Rothbard, and just, you know, his Libertarian Manifesto, and it's absolutely brilliant. And I would have said my answer to your question would have been a whole analysis on whether a completely free market system with no governments is actually possible and what that would look like. I would love to see something like that. But now that I'm reading this book, I see it's already been written 40 years ago. So, yeah, I don't know, man. And so much good Bitcoin stuff has already been written.
I stumped you.
Yeah, you stumped me, dude. You stumped the fuck out of me. I have zero idea.
You know how much pride I take in stumping people sometimes? Well, all right. We'll have to do a third one at some point, and you got to come with an answer for that question. Because the reason why I like that question is, one, it draws on the ability for you to understand what's already been written, which obviously you have. And then two, it's what is like the intellectual frontier that has not been explored yet, right? Is really kind of what the question's asking. And part of the beauty of those frontiers is sometimes we know what they are, right? And so it's very easy to say, you know, hey, we want to go to this place or we want to do this thing. But other times you actually explore and discover by accident. Right. You know, the kind of canonical example is Christopher Columbus. He wasn't looking for the New World. He was trying to get to Asia. Right. Then just happens to find this other thing. And so I think that's part of, part of the question. But what next time we come with an answer.
Do you know what? Now that you say that, there might be one thing I could say. And I'm sure this has been explored, but maybe something. Maybe a modern libertarian manifesto like Rothbard's, but using Bitcoin as the core piece of 'cause Rothbard's entire writing, I guess, is built on the principle of private property, and with that core principle. He starts to build all the rest of the philosophies, you know, off the top of that. So, you know, maybe a more modernized version of those philosophies, but using Bitcoin as the source of, real private property that can't be manipulated. So that'd be, I guess, an interesting thing because. I guess you could almost blend that with the sovereign individual and Bitcoin and sort of say like, what would a future look like where, where the world functions as a truly pure capitalist free market, you know, society where you don't have the state, you don't have these coercive infrastructure that we have today. And at the core of it is these property rights that are hard coded into, you know, the source of wealth, Bitcoin. And then you have a voluntary society built around that. So that maybe that's a really long, convoluted answer to your question, but I think that's something that that's probably, I think, where a lot of the frontier thinking of Bitcoin is now, is like, yeah, Bitcoin's going to go to the moon. It's going to be worth millions of dollars one day, but what the fuck does the world look like when that actually happens? So maybe that's the area that we need more exploration of. So let's say I'm half stumped.
I love it, man. I love it. Let's wrap up there. I think this was a great conversation. I think people found a lot of value in it, and we will definitely send some people over to check out Amber. And then just keep doing you. It's always fun to see you kind of putting those ideas out there in the world. And I think we need more people doing it. So we'll have to do this again, maybe towards the end of the year.
For sure, brother. Thank you for having me on again, man. Appreciate it.